good evening, everyone. It's nice to see you all. So many here. Can everyone hear me okay? Or was I a little bit soft during the guided? So can you tell me? My name is John Parkway, and as Kendrick mentioned, I'm in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh, who is a Vietnamese Zen monk living in France, in what's called Plum Village. And I first went there in 1996, and then again 1999, but next week I'll be going back there again. It's a long time since I've been. All things being equal, between now and then, I'll be back after 13 years. I'm sure things will have changed a lot in that time. My apologies for being a little late tonight. I might teach mindfulness, but sometimes I don't practice it very well myself. So I had to ring my daughter to find out which room we were in. And fortunately she was at home. Got the email from Kendrick just said the title for the talk was nothingness. What? Nothing. We just had the title for the talk, nothing. Great. I can talk about nothing. Maybe we'll just sit here all night. Silence. Of course, my teacher Thich Nhat Hanh says that our greatest fear is that when we die, we feel that we will become nothing. And, maybe we have the idea that before we were born we were nothing, and after we die we're nothing. That our lifespan actually began on that moment when we took our first breath, and on that moment when we take our last breath, that will be the end of our lifespan. And, if we have that, then even if it's not really a conscious fear, that can fill us with that fear of what's sometimes described as the fear of annihilation. What's gonna happen to us after we die? But the Buddha taught a completely different way of understanding our existence. And what he taught was that birth and death are really just notions. They're ideas that we have of them. And that those notions, those ideas of birth and death are not real. So the fact that we think that they're true and they're really like an illusion, they're a powerful illusion, that means those sort of fears hold a great power over us. And this is what in our life can cause us suffering. So, today for instance, this morning there was a teacher strike on. I've got young kids and old kids. My young kids still go to primary school, and you know, we had to also take the school or mine until school didn't start till 11 o'clock. It wasn't a full day strike, it was just a stop work meeting. And so the neighbours' kids came over, and you know, I didn't handle it very well when a 7-year-old started beating into his 4-year-old sister. And you know, so I said, stop that, that's not very nice. Just looked at me and whacked her again. I said, okay, get away from your sister, move away, come on. Looked at me more defiantly, almost glared at me, and gave her a great right hook into the cheek. So, you know, and things like that, you know, anger can come up for us. You know, we're out of something that we're normally comfortable with. But if we look deeply into things, we can see that things like anger, there's something under the surface as well. And, you know, I thought about that all day. Why did I get angry? Like, something sort of like that. And, you know, here's this wise little 7-year-old kid who almost knows that I'm going to get angry when he does that. Knows he's going to get a reaction. But, you know, there's no doubt there's some fear there. Maybe it's the fear that, you know, I'm not going to be looking after this kid that I've got responsibility for. I'm feeling responsibility. You know, who knows what it is, but it's good for me to contemplate just something like that that happens. So, the Buddha taught that there's, in terms of nothing, this idea that you know, we come from nothing and we go to nothing, that there is no birth and no death. And he said also there's no coming and no going, there's no same and no different, and there's no permanent self, and yet there's no annihilation. So you can almost say no being and no non-being. And when we understand that we can't be destroyed, when we have that different view of the Buddha, that there is no such thing as birth and death, that we aren't subject to sort of annihilation, you know, our lifespan didn't begin just here, when we can start to look more deeply at that, then we can be free from our fear of that. So I know this is a very theoretical topic, or it can be, but I really don't want to sort of come and talk about theories in a way. I only want to talk about things that can help people to be happier, really, and not to suffer. So hopefully I can do that tonight, and we don't sort of get mired in like a you know, a theological intellectual discussion. But there are ways to demonstrate the idea that effectively the Buddha taught cause and effect, the law of cause and effect. If you like, the law of, sometimes called the law of retribution or the law of karma. But what it meant was that basically this is like this because that is like that. That's the simplest way that he put it. And if we look at, for instance, the cigarette lighter, we might know that there's the potential of a flame in this cigarette lighter. But the flame's not there at the moment. Does it mean the flame doesn't exist, or when I push this button there won't be a flame? No, of course we know there's one of those gases. The flame will come out, but it's not here at the moment because the conditions are not sufficient at this moment for the flame to be here. And conditions do we need? Well, we need some sort of energy, the gas, for instance. We need a spark, and of course, there's got to be oxygen in the room, otherwise the flame won't work. So if all those conditions are there, then we can get the flame. As soon as I take my finger off and cut the gas off, the flame doesn't exist anymore. Does it mean that the flame has gone forever? No, as soon as the causes and conditions are right again, the flame can exist. In fact, this flame can be transferred. It doesn't look like I'm supposed to light this candle, probably against university rules, perhaps a bit, I'm guessing. But if I were to get this flame and to light the candle, is the flame that I've transferred from the cigarette lighter to the candle, is that a different flame now? Or is it the same flame? Or is it just not the same flame? So, this is really just to make us to maybe think about this differently and to look differently into the way that we think. Sometimes we see the form of things, we see what things look like, and we make judgments about that, whether it's a person. We see someone and they're a nice smiling person and we think, oh, that person must be happy. Gee, I wish I could be like them. Yeah, they probably, you know, what are they doing right? You know? And we make all these judgments. We judge the book by its cover and effect. But we don't understand the causes and conditions. And to really get to know that person and really understand them, then you know, we have to look deeper. So I'm just going to put a little drink of water. Again, to sort of go back to the beginning about tonight, what I'd like to do is maybe talk until not much longer than 8:30, so then give everyone a chance for either to share their own insights or their own thoughts on this topic, or to ask questions. That would be okay as well. In terms of dying, maybe young people don't think about that too much. Okay. Why would you? It's a long way off. But, you know, I also teach young kids in primary school Buddhist scripture. And, you know, I've got to say, I was surprised to find that in my kindergarten class, in one of the first weeks I started, one of the kids just started talking about his grandfather who lived in England and who passed away. And we were just sharing in the group and asking people what had happened and things like that. So, you know, even at a young age, people can come into touch with the loss like that. And, you know, he just was sharing in the class and we didn't interrupt him, and it was pretty amazing, really, that he sort of, you know, said that he'd never seen his grandfather. You know, he's 5 years old. But his grandfather was obviously out of the country. He never met him, and you know, he had, you know, tears in his eyes, but he was still able to talk about it. So it can impact on us that loss of someone at any age. And in our tradition, actually, what we do is when someone is sick or someone is very ill or passes away, we give their name to the monastic. I don't know if you know this, and they we put that, actually, they have normally have a big bell with a monastic sitting, and you put that person's name in the bell. The monk or the nun will pull the name out at the beginning of meditation and will say, well, look, this person is, you know, we'll say, has passed away, or let's say passed away. And we'll think of them in our meditation, and we'll send kindness to that person. We'll, you know, also think of the person who's left behind, who's grieving. And, you know, whether we've thought about it or not, one day every one of us, metaphor, is going to have our name in the bell. So before Easter this year, we had a retreat, and we had monks and nuns come up. A friend of mine, who was 80 years old in our group, the monks and nuns came on a Wednesday. We were having the retreat, was starting on the Friday after Easter, and he came and met them. He had lunch with them, and then when I got to the retreat, I found out that he'd been in an accident and run over. And he died instantly. So, you know, his name was in the bell. So we can't really say when we're going to die. Maybe we all have an idea in our head that we're going to live to when we're 95, because, well, you know, my relatives all lived to an old, ripe old age, and, you know, maybe they'd never had any risk of heart disease, and so, you know, I should be able to live that long as well. To contemplate impermanence, or that idea of impermanence, is something that can help us be prepared for the eventuality when it does come. It's not that we need to be negative about it, but it is worth contemplating. And in fact, it can be a very hopeful thing, because if you appreciate that you really haven't got going to live forever, then maybe then you start thinking about, or if that loved one of yours or friend is not going to live forever, then maybe you start thinking about how you can appreciate them more in life. Yeah, so when my friend, his name was Kookaburra, because he always used to write poetry. He was a poet. He always used to write poetry about kookaburras. And he came from Vietnam. And, you know, he was a person who came from Vietnam on a boat, and he had a wonderful story about, well, I don't know about wonderful, but very interesting stories about, you know, the coming to Australia on a boat and, you know, being held up by pirates and things. He was a very joyful person, and he would always write, and he was fascinated by the fact that we have this bird here in Australia that actually laughs all the time. He always used to write poems about that, and he made people happy with that. So, you know, my memories of him are very fond. And, you know, I was on the retreat, and as I always seem to do, I felt inspired to actually write a poem about him, which I did. But, you know, I thought about it later, and I thought, oh, you know, I've got to stop doing this, because every time someone dies, you know, affects me emotionally, and the way I sort of get that out is I write this poem, and it's not particularly for anyone. I mean, the person who's died doesn't get to hear it, of course, but it sort of helps me to write down how I felt about that person. But, you know, I thought, I'm going to start writing poems about people before they die and show them the poem and show them how much I appreciate it. And then a friend of mine said, yeah, well, you know, I just do it on Facebook. So, you know, I think that's a great, I guess, thing that people use these days to stay in touch and to say, you know, good things about those people who are their friends or who are their loved ones. They can do it on Facebook, or, you know, you have that avenue of technology that allows you to do that. And, you know, if you think about impermanence, then, you know, maybe you'd be motivated to actually do something or say, rather than saying, oh, you know, oh, I can put that up to next week. You know, I'd really like to say something. be like, I'm not suggesting you're going to want to write a poem like me. My poems aren't very good, I've got to tell you. Whatever it is that you do or that you want to say to that person, do in our tradition is also we stop, so you know, giving you all this talk and there's all these things going around in your head and you're thinking about things, but now what I'd like you to do is to stop and to go back to your breath for a little while. I'm just going to have a little interlude here, maybe for 3 or 4 or 5 in-breaths and out-breaths. We're not going to have any thinking during that period. It's going to be a non-thinking zone. Can just relax and smile and be with our breath, and we can do that for the time that the bell sounds. That little interlude is like a gift you can give yourself during the day at any time. You know, if you're in lectures, if you're rushing between, well, if you're like me, you tend to rush. You're running after things all the time. You know, find a place where you can stop. You know, or something that is like a bell. It might be the sound of an aeroplane going. It might be when you're driving, when you stop at a red light. Take that moment just to go back to your breath and just refresh yourself with that. Not having anything on your mind, not rushing. Just go back to your half smile and your breath and relax. You don't have to close your eyes if you're at the red light because you might miss the green. But you can just let go of all that thinking and all that worrying. You know, don't worry about what happened this morning with the, you know, the flare-up with the little kid. Just relax. Give yourself a little bit of peace in your day for that time. And if you can do that, like, a little bit more regularly and more regularly, then you'll have lots of these little interludes during the day. And actually your day will be very relaxed and very peaceful, very joyful. I only started teaching kids, little kids, Buddhist scripture last year. But I've got to say, I really started to, and I was completely out of my comfort zone. Particularly the kindergarten kids were the ones that really used to freak me out. But things change, and actually I'm starting to enjoy it a little bit, you know. And there's a few things, a few rules, you know. I'll let you know a few of my little secrets that like people have told me about, like, you know, teaching kids and things. So one of them is, you know, sort of tell them jokes. Well, I'm not very good at jokes, but they actually like singing songs. What I found is that adults aren't so good at singing songs. We're also very self-conscious. We're in the public, I mean, I think the people on The Voice are an exception, you know, they like to get up on stage and they can sing, you know. Not all of us can. But the kids, they don't worry about that. They love to sing. They really love them. And of course they like stories. And also love to, I'm surprised how much they love the colouring. So as long as I sort of fit all those things in now with kindergarten kids, then that's great. A lot of those things are also true for adults. We like to have varied things, maybe not the singing. I had a song that I brought tonight to sort of explain the idea of that we're not a separate self, that we are sort of, we have this idea of the word Thich Nhat Hanh uses is intervening. So it means that we don't exist as a separate self. There are all sorts of causes and conditions that come to us. Our parents are a part of us. We're influenced by our friends, of course. The experiences that we've had in our life, they affect us and they make us who we are now. You know, we go into the future in the same way. So if we can relax and have a little bit of like one of those little joyful intervals in our day, then we'll feel more joyful and you know, we'll be happier. And you know, it's a funny thing, it's sort of like a bit contagious, that when you're happy, the people around you also can be happy. It's very true that if you offer kindness to people, that you get it back. It's not that you do it for that. Count how I get the score, you know. I was kind to you. It's when you owe me. No. You don't do it like that. You just offer kindness, and you offer kindness for no reason. And what happens is, you know, you don't necessarily get it back today, but you get kindness back. There's this story about this lady, and she's got her hands and knees on a street corner, and you know, it's night time, and she's looking, I don't know if it's a story, she's looking for something, and this man walks past, and lost something, have you? And, yes. Gets down, and says, oh, let me help you. What are you looking for? I'm looking for a needle. Where exactly did you lose it? Because he started looking with her and, you know, they found it, yep. He says, oh, actually I lost it inside my house, but the lights aren't working and there's a better light out here, I'm looking out here for it. Wow, this is right from that. So I told you it wasn't great. But, sometimes things are like that. We're looking for something, and we're looking outside of our home, if you like, for it. But what we need to find, really, is already inside us. So the story, this is not a joke anymore, is of into being that Thich Nhat Hanh tells, is that of a river or a stream, and that stream is flowing, and when it's still, it's sort of reflecting everything that goes by on the banks of the river, the trees, and the sky and the clouds, night, the
ever sees these beautiful white fluffy clouds and falls in love with them and becomes really attached and just wishes that it could be a cloud. And all day long this river's flowing and it's looking up and seeing the reflection of the clouds in it and seeing the clouds, and it just wants to be a cloud. And of course it does this day and night until, you know, one day it actually manages to get to speak to the cloud, and the cloud explains to the river that a thing called rain happens, and when it rains that the cloud falls to the ground and becomes the river. The river then, of course, sees that it no longer needs to think that it needs to be like the cloud, because in fact the river also speaks to the cloud, and the cloud tells the river that it came from the river. So not only will it become the river, but it also came from the river. And this is the idea of interbeing. And you know, we come from our parents, say, and it's just like we're in a stream of life. And there are things that we do. We may not have children necessarily, but we will impact on others. And that experience, that interaction that they have with us, those other people, you know, that will continue. So how can we say that, you know, something that we've said that's, say, kind to someone else, it has not had an impact on them and does not continue on like the stream. And even after we've passed away, you know, it's not as though that kindness or that word that you said to someone isn't still remembered and carried on. So we might also have a little interlude again here. This time we're not going to do it with the bell, we're going to do something different. I'm not going to make you sing. But I would like you to stand up and just sort of get next to your chair, because what we're going to do is a few little movements. You've been sitting down long enough. I don't want you to be uncomfortable. And maybe you can just sort of move a little bit away from the person who's sort of next to you. Whatever we can do in mindfulness, actually. You know, you can walk in mindfulness from this lecture hall to the next tutorial or whatever you have. But you can also do movements in mindfulness. And so these movements, the first movement is just to be aware that your feet are touching the earth. And in fact, you can breathe in and out, imagining the air is coming up through the earth. Be aware of the movement of your arms. And now I go right up to the sides. shoulders. And this time we can open like a lotus flower. Just imagine a lotus flower standing here in the pond. The feet are like the stalk of the flower. The little parts of the balance. And the sun's coming up and the flowers are. Sorry if I talk about my scripture classes, but all the time. I try different things, last week, actually with my, I have kindergarten, I have year one, year two, year three, year four, year five, year six. Each of those groups are really quite different. You know, you just can't go in and do the same half hour with each of them. Half an hour can seem like a long time when you've got kindergarten kids. Actually, my kindergarten kids are like angels, but the year one, two kids, I've got 30 kids in class, and it only takes, it's like ping pong. Have you ever seen ping pong balls when they put them on a mouse trap and drop a ping pong ball in there and one goes pop, and then they all go pop, 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 pop. That's what my year one, two class is. One of them plays up, they all play up. So I took my year one, two class out and I thought, oh, okay, well, I'm going to try walking meditation. It's really weird. You go outside and we're going to just be aware of walking. We're going to be aware of our breath. We're going to look at the blue sky, beautiful trees and everything. Okay, yeah, we could do that. Yeah, you've got to be good because I haven't asked the head, you know, the principal this, and, you know, I'm not sure whether we're allowed to be out, you know. We're not allowed to make a noise, okay? Get outside into the playground. As soon as we hit the asphalt, it's like the kids are, ah, oh, this is playground. They all start screaming and running in all directions, and I go, come back. It took me about 10 minutes to get them back. They were jumping on seats and banging on windows of classrooms. It didn't work at all. But during the week, I tried the mindful movements with my kindergarten kids. I thought, oh, okay, I'm not sure what this is going to be like. And they were great. They could do things I didn't get you guys to try, but standing on one leg and, you know, balancing and doing the movement. And, it was amazing. So you never know what's going to work and what's not going to work. So I guess to finish on this topic, the idea of interbeing, I know I sort of said empty of a separate self. I mean, are we, what that means is, can we be a separate self? Can I just be here on my own without anything else? I think that question is best answered by, can the flame exist without the spark, or the gas that's in the spark, or somebody to ignite it without those causal conditions? To me, that's a pretty simple answer. It's the same idea as intervening. You know, can the stream exist without the cloud, without the rain, without the sun to evaporate? Can the cloud exist without the sun to evaporate the water and get it up into the sky? And can we exist without other factors? And then if we think of that extension to ourselves and how we interact with others. But that insight, or it can't be an intellectual insight, because that doesn't really help us. We might get that intellectually, we might sort of say, oh yeah, you know, I agree with that, or maybe we say, oh yeah, well, I don't really agree with that. And actually, either way, it doesn't really help us, whether we agree or disagree. What will help us if we can use that insight, or that insight of impermanence, whether it becomes a realization for us. In other words, then we understand it and we can bring it into our own life, and it helps us then to act in a particular way that makes us happy, or makes those around us happy. Otherwise, it's just knowledge. If it's an intellectual thing. And you know, the Buddha is very famous. The Buddha said that you know, my teachings are like a raft. What he meant was that you know, it's something to get you across that what was called the sea of suffering, but it's something that you use like a tool to get yourself over. You have using it for a particular purpose. But then once you get there, you don't keep carrying it around, because that would be silly. So it's not like something bit of knowledge that we hold on to and we think, yeah, I've got that. You know, I'm going to write it down, I'm going to remember it, and you know, if I have a test on it, I'll get it right. It's not like that at all. It's something that we use when we need it. And if we don't need it, then we don't carry it around with us. So, you know, you can imagine if you were a carpenter and you had your hammer and your screwdriver and things like that. And, you know, when you're doing your work, of course, you need those tools. You've got to, you know, hammer nails in and screws and all those sorts of things. But people would look at you a bit funny if you still had your tool bag around your waist when you went to a barbecue on the weekend and you carried those tools around. Of course, people don't do that. And that's the same with Buddha's teaching. We have to really have it as a realization. So we contemplate it, and then we find the ways that it can help us. And then if we use it in that way and we really get a benefit from it, then who is it that knows? It's not me telling you that, you know, you must know about interbeing and you will be happy if you listen to that, if you learn that. It's not about that at all. The only person who really knows is you from your own experience. So don't listen to me, even the Buddha said. Don't listen to my teachings. Find out for yourself. What I wanted to say this evening. With all the difficulties that I had in getting here and forgetting
forgetting things, and including the reason, one of the reasons we're not having a song is because I bought the CD player, but I forgot the CD. So. I'm having one of those days. I never saw so many ambulances and police cars on the way here. It was amazing tonight. It seemed like it was a bad night for accidents. So I almost had one myself just at Barker Street down there. The other side of Anzac Parade, there was a roundabout and there was an ambulance coming through there, and I thought the lady in front of the ambulance was going to stop, and so I thought, okay, she's going to stop, I'll go through the roundabout. So I started to go through the roundabout, and unfortunately she decided to speed up because she was looking at a rear vision mirror. I realised she'd slowed down because she was looking at a rear vision mirror later at the ambulance behind her, but screeched my brakes, stopped halfway in the roundabout. Fortunately, there was no accident. But there is a saying that I took down here of the Buddha that I think is about practice. And he said that the object of mindfulness and meditation, or in fact the holy life, is the unshakable deliverance of the heart. So it's to have faith in putting our heart into deliverance or practice, if you like. And, you know, if you put your heart into it, then the Buddha said that's the essence and the goal of meditation and practice. It's not to understand the teaching intellectually, but to actually put yourself into it, to have a go, and to have some faith and confidence that you can do it. So with that, let's have a sound of the bell. Interlude of joy. You know, I want to say this is a huge topic, and we sort of scratched the surface a little bit tonight, but I did try to you know, bring something that had sort of, if you like, something to do with nothing. Actually, I like to do nothing better than all the rest. I think that's a great topic. Whoever came up with it. Genius. So if anyone has anything to if they would like to share, or anyone wants to ask a question, we could do that now.
What was Plum Village like?
Yeah, what was Plum Village like? It was great. Next question.
What was the song that you said?
Oh, no, I was joking. I will answer that a little bit more. Look, Plum Village, it's in rural France, near Bordeaux. And it's set in a very much a wine region. So I've been there in the middle of summer when it's very hot, and a lot of the fields are full with sunflowers, which is just, I don't know if you've ever been in a place where they grow sunflowers, but it's just amazing. I mean, sunflowers are like, you know, as tall as people, and you can just imagine hillsides of just yellow looking at you. And they also follow the sun during the day, like they're bigger than a person's face.
But I have to say that like the best part of the experience of staying there is that a lot of people come from all around the world for the retreats. In the summer retreat, it's a family retreat. They have something, you know, more than 1,000. You know, the best part of the retreat, I think, is the people that you meet. And so when you're, I find anyway, when you're staying in a place like that, and after a while, you know, you get up in the morning and you get to meditate from like 5 o'clock, and then you'll have breakfast, and that's in silence. So you really slow down, and then you might do some working meditation, and they do walking meditation, and Thich Nhat Hanh might lead walking meditation outdoors, you know, around the forest that's around the, what they call it, the village or the hamlet. And, you know, after about 3 or 4 days, you really let go of everything. You don't want to look at the internet or the newspaper or watch TV, all of that sort of falls away, all those things that you normally actually amuse yourself with, that you don't realize that you're amusing. Oh, I'm talking about myself. But. And, you know, you become very, very peaceful and very calm. So each time I stayed there, I stayed like at least 3 weeks. And I've also stayed on winter retreats in North America. I've been to Vietnam. A group of people from around the world, like about 100 people, and also about 100 monastics. I would recommend it. Fong? Got the word that it's called watering the seeds of joy. Watering? And this is as a chant, but it's also been turned into a song. I'm really sorry that I couldn't bring the song along. Because I'm going to Plum Village, what happened was I have a CD with it on, and the person who's taking my Wednesday night class at the Buddhist Library, I remember saying to him on Wednesday night, he said, I need those CDs that you've got. I said, okay, take them tonight. He says, no, I'll see you next week. You keep them. I said, no, you take them tonight. I'll forget next week. So of course then I realised that it would be good to have it tonight, so anyway, I don't want to tell you my whole life story, but you're getting it anyway. So I went back to the Buddhist Library today, and ABCAP, who sort of like do Buddhism and psychology, they were running a course there for people who are doing a 2-year course. It's quite interesting, and I just happened to go in at lunchtime, and because I wanted to get copies that I could bring along. I'm happy to give these copies out to people with the words on it. However, I'm sorry that we didn't have the song, because we could have listened to it. I wasn't going to make you sing it. But I was going to give you the words to follow.
Wait,
did
you
sing? Maybe change it.
Well, time's up. Okay.
You know, sometimes you shouldn't ask for things like that. you don't know what you're getting. I could.
What I'll do is I'll hand this out.
I'm not sure we're going to, we probably won't have enough. You got it online?
Yeah.
Fantastic. I think the Buddha really taught that whole idea of cause and effect in the Four Noble Truths. He said that suffering is a reality. I think he sort of said that and pointed it out to people, because what we tend to do is, you know, we tend to sort of want to ignore that, or maybe do things that so we don't have to. We eat everything. Well, I don't make it happy, but it's a very short term thing. And we want a shopping therapy or whatever. So he really then taught that there are causes of suffering, and you look at that, you know, one of the main causes of again, what I do with my kids is the story of, like, you know, how in Asia that the way they catch monkeys, they put peanuts in a coconut. Big enough for the monkey to get his hand in there, and he gets in there and he grabs it, and he wants those peanuts really bad, and he gets attached to them, and but he can't get his hand out, so it's easy for the hunter to trap him. And we like that, we get attached to them. They're things that, you know, our mind, we want to break things into the things we like and the things we don't like. So it's the attachment that causes suffering. And then, of course, you know, if there are things that cause suffering, there are also things that can cause well-being for us. Or if we stop the things that actually cause suffering, maybe it's attachment to our ideas as well. So, I think that that whole idea of, you know, sometimes called karma or retribution, can be in terms of actions or things that happen, but also in terms of our environment. So if we go to a place like Plum Village, or if we hang around with Unibuzz and people are joyful and practice kindness to each other, then, you know, we get that karma as well. And that's like environmental karma. Maybe we get karma from previous lifetimes. Sometimes in a family, you know, I think in my family, I mean, it was just Anzac Day, and I was contemplating the fact that my grandfather, who, you know, suffered a lot, he was in a war, and in a way that still affects our family. He came back from that war, and he did probably that. What we call today post-traumatic stress syndrome, but they didn't have a word for it then, and people had to cope with it. He didn't cope with it very well. Came out in his anger, that anger, the family felt that. Starts off with Things don't always work out like you think they're going to. It's not all doom and gloom. I thought there was no way we'd hear that song tonight, but and I've got to say, as I was standing out in the middle of the avenue there, and I thought, oh, I don't have the phone number here and I can't contact, but maybe that I'll go home and I'll sit there and I won't find out where to get to tonight. But I got helped. Many times today. So. Does anyone else have any questions? You know, I know, with the temple that supports Unibuds is the main sponsor of you. I'm not sure how you say that. It's at Homebush, is that right? And I think they have their own program, as I've heard before, for offering scripture to young people. Is that correct? Maybe I'm too enthusiastic about it, but I say to even like the people who come to our group on a Wednesday, you know, if you've got some spare time, it's a wonderful thing to do to share the Dharma with young people. And you really don't need to be, have studied it and have a degree in it or anything like that. I mean, if you've been coming to some of these talks and you hear all these wonderful teachers that you have exposure to at Unibuds, you know a lot about it already, and you have more than enough knowledge of the Buddha's teachings to share it in much more creative ways than I do, I'm sure. I'm saying it's a wonderful thing to do, and I'm sure you've thought about it, or maybe there are some of you who do it here, but I would encourage you to do that. I do it through the Buddhist Council with the primary school system. They call it special religious education. And just as a Catholic priest can come along and talk to people about Catholicism or about Christianity, in primary schools, if someone wants to come along and teach Buddhism in that school, then they can. And in fact, there is something like 50 schools in New South Wales which have asked for Buddhism to be taught through the Buddhist Council, but they're that many short of teachers. There's a great need there. That's my sales pitch. The teaching the Dharma.